If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. We've all seen the film Downfall about the Führer bunker in Berlin in the closing days of the war, and we all know the story of how Adolf Hitler, with his new wife, Eva Braun, committed suicide and the body was destroyed. Well, how much of that story do we actually know? Since the end of the war, a series of newspaper reports, books, and more recently, TV series such as Hunting Hitler have all put forward the idea that Hitler escaped at the end of the war and that the official history, for want of a better phrase, is not the truth. In this episode, I'm joined by Luke Daly-Groves. Luke is a postgraduate researcher at Leeds University and the author of the new book Hitler's Death, in which he revisits the original post-war investigations by the Allied powers and, using all the data now available, assesses how accurate they were. In doing so, he also explores and debunks these Hitler conspiracy theories. Now, this podcast is brought to you by listeners like yourself who enjoy the show and help me find the time to put it together by becoming patrons, in committing to pay a dollar or two each month via Patreon, or even pushing the boat out and committing to a Rockefeller level of support, such as listeners like Kieran Byrne and Paul Rafter. Thank you guys for your support. You can find out more at patreon.com/WW2podcast. If Patreon is not your thing, for whatever reason, and you would like to join the gang, go to www.podcast.com/support, and you'll find information on how to support the show via PayPal. In doing so, if you check the box to be added to the mailing list, I will send you links to the extras when I have them. So, Luke, thanks for joining us. Shall we take as our starting point May 1945? How much did the Allies know of Hitler's death when the war came to an end?
It depends which Allies you're talking about, obviously. So the Soviets at this point they knew the most because they were the first to capture Hitler's bunker. And so they controlled the evidence and they decided what evidence from that point was to get out to the British and the Americans. The British and the Americans knew that there was a radio announcement given from Admiral Karl Dönitz, and he said that Hitler had died fighting to his last breath against the communists. And now Eisenhower and the high-ups at the Western Allies, HQ, they did all they could to sort of argue against this idea that Hitler had died a heroic death, because they were very frightened with what this could do to sort of stiffen German resistance at that time. But apart from the Dönitz announcement, the Allies basically had to rely on the Soviets for evidence at that stage, the Western Allies, that is. I think it was in June 1945 that one of Marshal Zhukov's staff officers came out and announced that they had found and identified the bodies of Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun. So from that point, they had confirmation from the Soviets that Hitler was dead and they had the body.
So, I mean, it's at this point we started to get Cold War tensions started to ramp up. I was going to say, presumably there is an investigation. I mean, and how much of it is it a joint investigation? So I have pictorially in my mind the vision of the Third Man, where the Russians and the Americans are all sort of going around together in groups in occupied... is it Vienna in the Third Man?
Yeah, Vienna.
Yeah. Is it like that? Are they all pulling together or are they all off in different directions? Because Berlin was obviously in the Russian sector.
Yeah, I would say that they're definitely all off in different directions. So I guess with the Western Allies, it was Scheif, Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force, the first sort of intelligence task, which certainly one of the key British intelligence officers, but also this American intelligence officer, Heimlich. Before the war was over, that they were told at Scheif headquarters that their first assignment once they got to Berlin was to find out what happened to Hitler. So that was their sort of effort. And then the Soviets were sort of doing their own thing because, they were the first in Berlin, and the Western allies, the British and the Americans, didn't occupy Berlin until the summer of 1945. So the Soviets had quite a lot of time on their own to see what they made of the evidence. And Stalin had time to work out politically what he wanted to do with the evidence. And I think that's quite important, because with that, you have one of the sort of major origins of the conspiracy theories, because it's not long after Zhukov's men come out and say that they've identified Hitler's bodies that Stalin decides to start telling people that Hitler's still alive. Zhukov gets word of this, and then Zhukov all of a sudden changes his tune and says, well, Hitler could have escaped. He could have flown away at the last minute to Spain or Argentina. And that's when things start getting political.
So the Russians are going their own way. Did the Americans and the British, did they have separate political agendas, or did they just not want to work together?
Well, certainly the British were willing to work with the Soviets. At the end of the war, British intelligence, this is, and they were really perplexed. The Foreign Office were confused. There's a quote in the book where a Foreign Office official, he says, I've no idea why the Soviets would be spreading lies, what interest they have in this. The evidence that I've read suggests that the British didn't start their sort of intense investigations into Hitler's death until later on in 1945, because they genuinely believed that the Soviets were just gathering their evidence, and then they were going to share it with the Western allies. So there was good faith from British intelligence sort of at the start of the investigations, and it was the Soviets really that were playing games, political games, which is unsurprising really when Stalin is the head of state.
Yeah, it is bizarre that they seem to what they were playing at, what his ultimate cards he thought he had up his sleeve to claim something completely country.
I think it's actually really consistent with Stalin's character, and it's actually a really clever thing to do, because Stalin had all sorts to gain from claiming that Hitler had escaped.
What did he have to gain then if he'd escaped? How could he have played those cards to his advantage?
Well, the first thing is that he got to humiliate Zhukov, and at this time he was getting suspicious of Zhukov as a potential rival. So Zhukov comes out, announces through his men that Hitler's dead, we've got his body, and then Stalin goes, no, you don't. And then he sort of looks stupid, and then that's a potential political rival. You know, he's taken down a peg. And then also he could use this idea of Hitler still living as an excuse for the Soviet forces to remain in disputed areas, because the actual zones of occupation had not been moved into at this time. And there were still disagreements going on to do with that territorial disputes. Some historians have claimed that he could have wanted to preserve Hitler as a common enemy, because maybe he didn't want to split with the Allies, and he was concerned that this might happen. But others have said, on the other hand, that it was advantageous for his sort of repressive system to sort of justify his sort of terror, but if you like, by saying, well, look, we've got this threat, so we need to keep clamping down. I think all of those reasons are possible, but you know, the only person who really knows why he said it is Stalin, and I guess we may never know unless some files turn up in Moscow, which might explain why.
So if we unpick the Allied investigation, I mean, I've written that wonderful. Do we have known knowns and known unknowns, or is that unknown knowns? Donald Rumsfeld type quote, you know, when we go through the inquiry, because I guess people are familiar with, you know, downfall and, you know, Hitler in his bunker. So what is the stuff that we just don't know? Is there that came out of that initial investigation?
For a while, the things which were unknown was the sort of forensic evidence, I guess, that sort of thing, because the Soviets kept the lid on it. And they maintained an official policy of silence for years after all of the contradictory evidence came out, obviously, with the British counterclaims. But now we have the forensic evidence, because Hitler's teeth have been tested numerous times, and it's been confirmed by forensic scientists that they are Hitler's. So that's obviously one major thing. I'm trying to think of things. I mean, because obviously the conspiracy theorists have an interest in saying that things are unknown and unknown.
Yeah, I sort of think along the timeline is, you know, if you, I mean, perhaps it's worth looking at the timeline of those final day or hour or whatever. If you look at that timeline, is there just glaring contradictions or omissions that the investigation couldn't fill in or perhaps glossed over?
I suppose the only thing that we don't know for certain is what Hitler may have said to Eva Braun before he put the gun to his head and pulled the trigger, because obviously the only two people in the room were Hitler and Eva Braun. I've seen Hugh Trevor Roper and his colleagues' sort of timeline of events and their summary of things which happened, and they also include where they got that evidence from for these events, and it's several eyewitnesses for each occurrence on each day. And now with the amount of memoirs that have been published, and also with the Soviet files being available as well, it's such a comprehensive picture.
It's Hugh Trevor Roper who leads the British investigation, isn't it? Who is he? I mean, how qualified was he to put the story together?
Well, he was considered by several high ups in British intelligence, Dick White being the main one, as being the most well-informed British intelligence officer when it came to the German intelligence services. He was the obvious choice to lead the Hitler investigations, because if anybody's going to help Hitler escape, you'd think that the German intelligence services would have something to do with it, being that it would involve a covert operation. And also, Trevor Roper had spent the summer of 1945 interrogating several of these top Nazis and those linked to intelligence as well. And he'd been following the evidence of Hitler's death as well, which Dick White knew. So he was a highly regarded member of MI6.
I've made a note that he tracked down Hitler's will. Do you want to tell us about that? That's quite a good story, isn't it?
Yeah, so So Trevor Roper had submitted his intelligence report on Hitler's death, which I think it was released to the press on the 1st of November 1945. And so he returns to Oxford. Then he gets a message from, I don't know who it was in intelligence, but obviously his intelligence connections. And they say, "We found a copy of Hitler's will. We think there's another one in Germany. So you're going to have to go back." And he goes, "Okay, we'll go back." So they think that this other copy of Hitler's will is in the American zone. So he has to work with the American Counterintelligence Corps, the CIC. He ends up finding one copy of the will, which was buried in the back garden in a bottle, which is quite interesting. And I think he says in one of Trevor Roper's memoirs, because he kept diaries himself. I think Trevor Roper says it was when he was stood in the garden with this SS man that he realized that he was completely unprotected and he could have just led him into the garden to axe him to death or something like this. But yeah, it's a really interesting intelligence tale, really. And it's a good story of cooperation between the British and the Americans as well. A few people that have read the book have said, "Well, how do you think it's a good story of cooperation?" Because of course you have the big incident of rivalry where Trevor Roper leads the operation to discover the will. He issues orders that, you know, this is to be kept quiet until we can compare it with the copies with our copies of the will. And General Truscott decides to call in the press and make this announcement that, you know, the American forces have captured and discovered Hitler's will, much to the dismay of the British authorities and to Trevor Roper. And people say, well, because that happened, how on earth is this an example of cooperation? I say, well, Trevor Roper, in his private letters to his cousin, Brian Melland, he says that he didn't publish the full story of how he discovered Hitler's will and how it was released to the press because he wanted to preserve Anglo-American solidarity. So I think that is actually a tale of cooperation, because so important was it that the British and the American intelligence services were friends in Germany and could cooperate together that he decided to not publish this story.
It's such a bizarre document to turn up, you know, when the world's coming to an end around you, there's a will gets smuggled out and then presumably becomes a hot potato that people don't necessarily want to have anymore, hence it ends up in a bottle in the garden. It was probably a real honour to carry it out, and then you realise what's happening to the world and you think, I better get rid of it quite quick.
Yeah, well, the document caused a lot of controversy, and I think out of all the research I've done into British and American intelligence cooperation and rivalry in Germany, I think it's one of the main incidents of rivalry which happened, which just shows you how important these investigations into Hitler's death were.
That brings us to the conspiracy theories, which presumably these investigations are trying really to put a definitive full stop on Hitler's life and what's happened. So how soon, I mean, if we take away Stalin's pronouncements, how soon do they start to appear after the war?
It really does start with the Soviet press. And of course, once the Soviets, the British intelligence sort of put up with this idea that Hitler may have escaped at first, because they thought, okay, we'll wait and see what evidence the Soviets have got for these claims. But then when they turn around and say, actually, the British are hiding him in Hamburg, they go, hang on, well, this is getting a bit out of control now, so we're going to have to investigate properly, which is why they assign Trevor Roper. So the origins are very much with Stalin and his political aims, although they do develop all sorts of movements start disseminating them for their own reasons. So it begins with the communists, but then the Nazis start spreading the idea that Hitler still lives for their purposes.
The one thing that struck me was they seem to grow legs all of their own, almost like Elvis sightings, you know, the lady on the train who's in the States and she thinks she's sat next to Hitler because there's a German-looking man with a moustache. You know, they're so bizarre, some of them. That one particularly jumped out of me, of, you know, who sits in a train bored looking at people wondering if it's Hitler. I mean, how credible are such rumours? I mean, did he have a double? Could that have been an argument that he got away, or in fact that what people are saying is his double?
Well, in the books that I've read, that some historians argue that one of the bodies which the Soviets found was a guy called Gustav Weller or Weber, and I think some historians claim that that was Hitler's double. I haven't seen any evidence for that myself, but then I haven't looked into the earlier files during the war. I mean, apparently there's something in Operation Foxley in the National Archives which might show something to do with the double.
Foxley's the assassination attempt on Hitler, isn't it? Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. And I think a few colleagues have said that if you're looking for information on that, then you should look in there. But then again, some of the historians claim that this guy wasn't Hitler's double. It was just a corpse which the Soviets had dressed up to look like Hitler and then took pictures of. So it's never really been determined whether that was a double or not. But it's certain that the body, the remains rather, because what was left, what wasn't really a body, it was a pile of garbled mess and mush with teeth in it. They were Hitler's. It certainly wasn't a double. And this idea of a double did actually emerge in 1945, because some of the witnesses from the bunker, they claimed that newspaper reporters had been approaching them and saying, but was it really Hitler that you spoke to in the bunker? Are you sure it wasn't a double? And they were sort of trying to push this idea that it was a double, obviously because they wanted a good story, a good scoop to sell in the newspapers. And Trevor Roper himself, he looked into this idea of a double. And he basically followed all the leads to try and find some evidence that these bodies could have been a double, and all he found was newspaper speculation and these attempts by journalists to sort of force the opinion on eyewitnesses, and of course all the eyewitnesses said, no, this is absurd, no, it was Hitler. Just on the double point, because double trouble tends to come up quite a lot when we discuss this subject. Not only is the sort of the evidence of the intelligence investigations point against that there being a double, but it doesn't add up from all we know of Hitler and his inner circle in the last days. So I say, you know, Magda Goebbels murdered her children because she didn't want them to live in a world without National Socialism. And she didn't do this until she was absolutely certain that Hitler was going to commit suicide. And there's no way in hell she would have done this if she knew Hitler was escaping to some sort of sunny holiday retreat, you know, and a double was committing suicide in his place.
When these reports sort of start filtering in of of sightings, do they get investigated? I mean, is there any credibility given to them by the intelligence services?
Yes, I think Hugh Trevor Roper's investigation, which is sort of the first detailed investigation into this, they give the idea that Hitler escaped. He approaches it with an open mind. So he approaches the evidence the same way I approach the evidence. Okay, I'm going to take every eyewitness on their merits. I'm going to investigate what they say and to see where this comes from, what are the origins of the evidence. He operates on a really good methodology. He basically tries to support every single claim that he writes with more than one eyewitness, which is absolutely fantastic, which obviously makes his conclusions much more credible to me. So yeah, he does. He investigates these rumors of survival quite thoroughly, and of course he finds them all to be nonsense. And that's really good for my case against conspiracy, because most of the modern conspiracy theories, particularly Grey Wolf, they have very little original content in them. They're actually just recycled versions of these survival rumors, which have been circulating in newspapers since 1945. So the fact that Trevor Roper goes and investigates them in detail and disproves them just means that I can use the same evidence now to disprove the recycled versions in 2019. So,
are they still investigating them into the 70s, some of these odd sightings? Presumably when they pick up, it's Eichmann, isn't it? That must have kicked off another round of rumours and sightings, which if they get investigated again, it kind of all becomes self-perpetuating.
The capture of Eichmann, that did sort of inspire, you know, some people to say, well, particularly newspapers, well, if Eichmann escaped to Argentina, why couldn't Hitler escape to Argentina? But I haven't seen any evidence that inspired any more intelligence investigations into Hitler's suicide. I think, there was the odd one in 1960, I guess, with the FBI. But even at that stage, the FBI were saying, There was some lady that thinks that she saw Hitler in a cafe, I think, in 1960 in America, and the FBI basically just said, please don't encourage her by investigating this. So yeah, I think they peter out the investigations in the 1950s, but since 1945, the British certainly, they aren't investigating the idea that Hitler could have escaped. They're investigating the people that are spreading these rumors, because they want to know, why are people spreading these rumors? They're more interested in the people who are spreading the rumors than they are in the rumors themselves, because at this point they've got enough evidence to satisfy them that Hitler is dead. So they're more interested in the motivations of conspiracy theorists. This is something which scholars have generally not looked into in enough depth. But it's a crucial point for disproving conspiracy theorists, I think, because they obviously say, you know, if there's nothing to this idea that Hitler escaped, why are the Anglo-American intelligence services still looking for him in the 1950s? And I say, well, they're not looking for him. They're looking to see if these rumors are being spread for subversive purposes by neo-Nazi movements, or if they could perhaps indicate the path that other Nazis could have taken, such as Eichmann, to escape to Argentina. So it's less about the idea that Hitler could have escaped and more about the intentions of those that are spreading rumors that he did at that stage, at that late stage. At first, they approached it with an open mind.
My other point, which I know is incredible, is not credible, I should say, was the idea of Hitler escaping Berlin in the mayhem of everything happening. Presumably this is the basis for a lot of the conspiracy theories. He's got to have got out somewhere. And presumably there are a number of people who get out. I mean, how were they getting out? I mean, Martin Bormann is the classic one to have disappeared.
Well, Martin Bormann tried to escape, but he tried to escape too late. He obviously ended up dead because they found his body in Berlin, and again that's been proven forensically to belong to Martin Bormann. There's no question about that, and the evidence is in my book as well, because I saw fit to write a chapter on real escapes from the bunker, which is what I call it, and other Nazis that escaped from the bunker. Because,
and I have to say, it's a really interesting chapter on the overview, so almost on the fall of Berlin and how absolutely desperate these people were to get out. And Bormann's story was amazing.
Yeah, I mean,
tracking him down,
I can't imagine the well I can imagine in fact the chaos of the time, because I don't know who it was, right? I'm sure a few people whose accounts of that time I've read have said that they lived in Berlin, obviously prior to the heavy Soviet artillery fire, and they said, you know, a walk that used to take 5 minutes would now take 30 minutes or more due to the smoke and the fire and the flames, basically. So conspiracy theorists tend to rely on this idea, though. It wasn't just Hitler who escaped. He was helped to escape by people like Martin Bormann or Heinrich Müller, the head of the Gestapo. So I thought, well, if I look into how they the evidence surrounding the alleged escape of these individuals, and I can sort of disprove them, then the dominoes start to fall, because if he didn't escape with Bormann and he didn't escape with Müller, then who helped him escape? It was interesting to see how the Hitler and Bormann survival rumors sort of interlinked and morphed together as well, because you tend to find that people that say Hitler escaped, once that story got a bit stale, I guess, after the initial 10 years of circulation, they move on and start saying, actually, it was Bormann who escaped, you know. And they have the same motives and the same same flawed methodology of evidence selection as well that they use with the Bormann thing. You tend to find that people that argue one conspiracy theory, that they believe in several conspiracy theories, because it's their view of the world. So I thought that because books like Grey Wolf were claiming that not just Hitler, you know, Hitler and his inner circle escape, that I should look into this idea. I'm quite happy that I think the chapter on Bormann's escape is probably the most concise.
Tell us what happens to Bormann, because, you know, we're talking around it, but it is a good example of a mystery solved, isn't it?
Yeah, Bormann he escapes from the bunker after Hitler's suicide in one of the breakout groups, because they basically after Hitler dies, they all try and save their own skins, those that don't stay behind and kill themselves, obviously. So Bormann escapes, and he runs into a group of Soviet soldiers at one point, and he decides that he's not going to escape the Soviet ring, basically, which obviously some others did. Some others that met up with Bormann, they managed to go a different way and escape. Axman, I think it was, Arthur Axman, the head of the Hitler Youth, he splits up from Bormann. They basically come to this intersection, and Axman goes one way, Bormann goes the other. Axman later has to come back on himself, and he sees Bormann dead on the floor. But because of the way he's lying, and obviously Axman is trying to escape the Soviets as well, he doesn't have time to really inspect the bodies. So he assumes that they've been shot in the back, because he couldn't see any wounds on them and they were lying flat. But it's now assumed that Bormann had just decided to take a cyanide capsule, because he saw no way out of the Soviet encirclement. For years, Axman was the only testimony that the intelligence services had to sort of prove this idea of Bormann's suicide, because there were some other witnesses who said that he could have escaped, basically, because that they don't know what happened to him after the breakout groups, and Axman was the only one that saw him there on the floor, dead. So Hugh Trevor Roper kept an open mind about the possibility of Bormann escaping, and I think that adds to his credibility, the credibility of his conclusions about Hitler's death, because he was willing to say, okay, I only have Axman's testimony about Bormann's death, so I'm not going to say that he couldn't have escaped, because it's possible that Axman's lying, because I only have one source. And that's what's so good about Trevor Roper. He tries to back everything up with more than one source. So later, I think it's in the 1970s, during construction work in Berlin, they discover two bodies near a bridge in Berlin, where Axman said that he saw the dead bodies of Bormann and I think it was Stumpfegger, which was who was with him. They basically they dig these bodies up. Conspiracy theorists carry on. They say, oh no, this isn't Bormann, even though articles come out which analyze the teeth and compare it to the dentist of Bormann, who says no, this is Bormann, and the conspiracy theorists still say no. But eventually, one of Bormann's relatives consents to DNA analysis. And they compare the DNA of one of Bormann's relatives to the Bormann remains, and it's confirmed that it matches, basically, the body is Martin Bormann.
And now, has anything in the last 20 years or so, or 30 years, you know, we get the fall of Russia, has anything in respect to how Hitler died sort of genuinely new turned up, or did we really all know it all in 1945?
Oh no! So since the release of the Russian files, there's been tons more eyewitness testimonies have came out. So the Russians held on to several key eyewitnesses to Hitler's suicide, and that they interrogated them really thoroughly, as you can imagine, the Russians to interrogate. And these files were published in a book, a really useful book, also called Hitler's Death. I can't remember the subtitle. I think I got it on my shelf up here. Where is it? Russia's Last Great Secret from the Files of the KGB. And these are basically all published verbatim, translated into English, which is really good for researchers that want to look at it, because obviously I don't speak Russian. But yeah, there's so many testimonies in there, so many interrogations, and they all confirm basically what Trevor Roper said. They just add a bit more anecdotal detail onto it. So there's a few more stories of what Hitler said, what he was doing, you know, just sort of the little details which can get lost to Hitler, to history rather than lost to Hitler. They basically just confirm what Hugh Trevor Roper said all along, which is what's so marvelous about his work, really, because he completes the intelligence report in such a short space of time, which is something that conspiracy theorists have used to say that he rushed the investigations. But it's not that he rushed them. He was just incredibly efficient. And he also built on a lot of evidence which had been gathered before by various British intelligence agencies. And also he had the cooperation of the Americans, which really helped. So he had an immense amount of manpower as well. So there's all sorts of good reasons as to why Trevor Roper's investigations are valid all these years later.
So now, as so many boxes are ticked, is there still new rumours and myths and conspiracy theories coming out surrounding Hitler's death? Or is the internet only fueling them?
Well, the three-season... series of Hunting Hitler on the History Channel. It only finished last year, I think. And last year, Harry Cooper, a guy who wrote the book called Hitler in Argentina, he actually managed to get an article in the Express newspaper last year as well, where he was putting forward his theories. He claims to have solid proof that Hitler escaped to Argentina, which is something I take issue with in the book, as you know. So they're very much relevant. And it's probably every week I wake up and see on social media some sort of website has published something about Hitler escaping, or these files prove that the FBI had evidence that Hitler escaped. It's a very interesting way that they do it, because what they do is they take an FBI file which just describes a survival rumor. So some guy claims that Hitler, you know, escaped on horseback to a ranch. And what they do is that they'll publish this file and say, look, the FBI had evidence that Hitler had escaped and they were investigating this. But what they leave out is that general statements by people such as Hoover, the head of the FBI, he states explicitly that there is no evidence whatsoever, no convincing evidence that Hitler has escaped to Argentina. So they leave out the conclusions and opinions of intelligence officers who had actually investigated these rumors. And what they do is they just publish the rumors taken out of context as if the conclusions on the investigations into them don't exist.
They cherry pick facts to prove a point.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Whereas I've tried to put the rumors back into the correct context. So one thing which conspiracy theorists will say is that the FBI files, they contain thousands of leads to Hitler in Argentina. And yes, they do. They contain a lot of information about survival rumors of Hitler living in Argentina. But what they don't tell you that there is just as many files, if not more, which place Hitler in America. And these are also filed alongside documents which say that Hitler was in Japan or that he was in Canada. And there's no, as far as I'm aware, there's no FBI file with the label on it, Hitler in Argentina. They were all considered together as survival rumors of Hitler. And the conspiracy theorists, that they just decide that, I don't know, if they throw a dart on a map or something and say, oh, well, I'm going to write a book about Hitler escaping here. And then they just go through these files and pick those ones out and ignore all the others. When really, the people spreading these rumors, they have very similar motives, which is really revealing. So if you can look at the motives of those saying that Hitler escaped to America, and you can debunk those theories, it really helps with disproving those that say he escaped to Argentina as well.
Presumably, the motive now is invariably finance. Sell a book or a TV program or a...
Yeah, so it would be wrong of me to sort of speak for the modern conspiracy theorists and say, I know why you're doing this, because I've only spoke to a couple in person. but it'd be wrong of me to put words in their mouth and say this is their intention. I don't know if they actually believe this stuff, but I've explored what are the definite motives of conspiracy theorists in the 1940s and 50s. And I've said that these are several. So you have journalists who are seeking money. You have individuals who aren't journalists that are after money. You've got people that do it for political reasons, neo-Nazis, communists. You've got people who are mentally ill. You've got people that just like sensation or pranks and hoaxes. Initially, you've even got some war criminals. So there's all sorts of motivations. And what I say in the book is that it's probably reasonable to assume that the motives of the modern theorists, considering that their theories are so similar, are identical to the motives of their predecessors. In that, if it's produced by a journalist, then perhaps it's to spread sensation and through that to make money, which was definitely the case in the 40s and 50s.
Now, the one thing, I guess the elephant in the room, now we've got one right through it, is so what happened to Hitler? So if you take us from what happened to Hitler, how did Hitler die?
For several days in the Führer bunker, Hitler is announcing his intention to commit suicide. And I suppose the most famous occurrence of this is in the movie Downfall, which we discussed a little earlier, and it's been parodied all over YouTube when he throws his pencil across the table, and he says, you know, if you think that I'm going to leave Berlin, gentlemen, you're mistaken. I'd rather put a bullet in my head. And from that point on, really, he's announcing his intention to commit suicide. And then there's even discussions in the bunker of the best way to commit suicide, and it all gets really morbid. So people are just waiting for it. They're expecting it to happen. And of course, there's these odd glimmers of hope. So it's sort of, it oscillates from anxiety to hope and back to despair. So he has these sort of little moments of, perhaps Wenck will come. Perhaps Wenck's army is going to save me, you know. And he starts, oh, well, maybe like Frederick the Great, you know, I can at the last minute, I can turn the tide. But then he goes back to the gloom and, you know, I'm going to commit suicide. And he tells several members of his staff that he doesn't want to be paraded in a monkey cage in Moscow. He'd rather kill himself. And this is really consistent with Hitler's character and beliefs. As I say in the book, you know, he expected his generals, if they were ever captured, he wants them to commit suicide. He thinks that's the right thing to do. He sees that as an honorable way. As an honourable way to die rather than capture. So it's much more consistent with Hitler's personality than the idea of him escaping. And this is something which other Nazis at the time said as well. You know, the idea of Hitler escaping to live as an unknown man quietly in Argentina, it just doesn't fit. You know, the man throughout his whole career, he couldn't keep his mouth shut. So he's not going to start doing it, you know, at that stage. He's going to go for the extreme solution because he was very extreme. And the extreme solution was that he was going to marry Eva Braun. And through that marriage, which is a bizarre occurrence, through that marriage, he has divorced himself from the German people because he considered himself married to the German people. That's why he wouldn't commit fully to Eva Braun. He wanted to be seen as accessible to two German women so that they would idolize him more. At that moment, and he explains this in his will, he says explicitly in his last will and testament, he says that he's marrying Eva Braun and he intends to commit suicide with her. And this is seen as a great thing to do. And it's the way they want to go down in history. Before it happens, he gathers the members of his staff, the close members of his staff who are left with him in the bunker. And he lines them up and he goes down the line and he, you know, shakes hands and gives them sympathetic looks, and then he disappears into his private quarters. And obviously what goes on behind that door is the big mystery, as you say, if there's anything which we don't know. It's the method of suicide, which still causes debate between historians. Was it cyanide? Was it cyanide and the pistol, or was it just the pistol? I personally think, from the evidence that I've seen, that he shot himself. Just shot himself, because all the eyewitnesses describe smelling bitter almonds on Eva Braun's corpse, but they don't describe this smell on Hitler's corpse. They all say that there was blood on Hitler's face and on his head. Obviously, no blood on Eva Braun's corpse when they entered the room and took him up the stairs into the garden and set him alight. Yeah, so that's one of the things which all the eyewitnesses actually agree on, is that Hitler had blood on his corpse, whereas Eva Braun had none. And that's how we determined that Eva Braun took cyanide and Hitler had shot himself. So the last days in the bunker is it's obviously a fascinating time in history. And all the memoirs of the staff that were there, they're all really illuminating into Hitler's character, because if you can imagine, in the stress of the situation, all the sides of his character come out. So you have the evil and the vengeance in Hitler when he orders the execution of Fegelein because of Himmler's betrayal, as he sees it, and he raves against him and Göring. But then you also have Hitler's softer side, if you like, the more personal Hitler, where he's playing with his German Shepherd Blondie's puppies in the bunker as well. So yeah, I guess that's part of the fascination of the last days, is that you get to see Hitler as the man rather than as the dictator on the podium and on the Führer, and as the Führer on the world stage. And it's quite frightening in that way, because if you see Hitler as a human being with terrible ideas, which is what I call him in the introduction to the book, then the evil of Nazism is much scarier, because you think, well, if he wasn't a monster and he was a human being, then, you know, this could happen again, because he's human, you know, he's not this
the banality of evil.
Yeah.
Well, Luke, thank you for that. If anyone is interested in picking up a copy of Luke's book, it is Hitler's Death, published by Osprey. I will put a link on the website, www.podcast.com. So that's it for this episode. If you enjoy the show, why not give me a like on Facebook? I do post things in support of the latest podcast that I find interesting, and it's always nice to hear your comments. As I said at the start, if you want to become a patron of the podcast, you can find me at patreon.com/ww2podcast. So that's it for now. I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, it doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcast FREE.